I'm Mark Wunderlich, the acting director of the University of Arizona Poetry Center, and I want to thank you all for coming out this evening. First, I would like to thank Shane House for providing a venue for tonight's reading and effectively opening their home to us. We really do appreciate that. And I'd especially like to thank Ashley Hatcher, Gretchen McPhee, Brendan McBride, Courtney Hamilton, and Karen Falkenstrom for their vigilance and superior organization skills, which made this reading and residency possible. Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank those readers who juried this year's competition for their time and commitment to this program. The summer residency program of the Poetry Center offers a one-month residency to a writer selected from a national competition of poets, fiction, and creative nonfiction. In its second year, the residency is an opportunity for an emerging artist to enjoy the resources of the Poetry Center's library and archives, and introduces them to Tucson's vibrant writing community. The residency provides accommodations in the Poetry Center's guest house and, hopefully, the time and quietude to produce new work, revise old work, read, or, if he or she chooses, to do absolutely nothing. It is, as the poet William Matthews once called it, art jail, but in a world whose velocity seems to be increasing, we hope to be a point of respite, a slow spot on the road where a writer can perhaps find some solitude and presence of mind to do what it is they do best. It's my great pleasure to introduce the poet Kimberly Taylor, this year's recipient of the University of Arizona Poetry Center's summer residency. Kimberly's poems have a grace and a fury stemming from a poetic imagination I can only call labyrinth. Actively engaged with the natural world, she is a natural descendant of Sylvia Plath and Amy Clampett, but their influences remain shadows on what is clearly a singular imagination, with its home in some luminous poet-created world of, and I'm quoting Kimberly, late American promises spread out before her like a fan. As a poet, Taylor pushes language to its farthest, edgiest limits, whether that be its Germanic Old English roots or to the fragmented musical notation of birdsong, the goal of this pushing to be the creation of a system and a world where her extraordinary characters can thrive. Kimberly received her MFA from Columbia University's School of the Arts Writing Division, where she also acted as the poetry editor of Columbia, a magazine of poetry and prose. She has poems forthcoming in Inky Blue and the Hawaii Review, and has worked as a journal editor and comedian in Washington, D.C. She currently lives in New York City and South Bend, Indiana. It's my pleasure to introduce Kimberly Taylor.
Thanks very much, Mark. I just want to begin by thanking the incredible, phenomenal staff of the Poetry Center, who has just made my stay here the best kind of art jail I would ever be in and would never want to leave. So thanks to Mark, Karen, Brendan, Gretchen, and Courtney, all of you. Thank you, really. I'm going to start with a poem that is sort of the Southwest version of Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. I don't know if you're familiar with the children's book, but I thought it needed a little Southwest flavor, and here I am in the Southwest, so I thought I'd give it a shot. Where the Wild Things Went. Just before the Ocotillo began to recede from the bathroom mirror, before saguaros permit the ceiling to descend and the stars fade back into bedspread, I will hunt the wildest, chart the grasses flattened by their great hooves, track their spore through the pecan grove to the edge of the precipice, far above the fiery fronds, and in and out of years, beyond the indolent ancestral indigo, I see the extravagant weavers and the wild things bellowing and flexing their claws and furred and unsorrowed clefts. I see the Archimedean point from which a girl lifts the whole world, our instructions written upon her immense hand. She tells me that the being woven is the net that will catch me as I fall beyond the certain words, the certain times that I am. Homesick for what I do not know, for what is not near. I was diving with my mother in the Exumas, and we came upon a large mysterious creature and her little baby that really scared the heck out of us. But later I found out the name of it. It was a cow-nosed ray, and that's the title of this next poem. The aqueous flume assembles into a giant ray, hugging the inreef, crushing mollusks in her tooth plates. Her body, a graved-winged teapot, pinches up into a pug nose. Subrostral lobes extend from the midnight disc of her body, the outer corners falcate, the posterior edges concave. Behind her stiffens the venomous tail spine. Her eyes are sensitive to exterior, to the pup just visible beneath the wing. A miniature spout of her, he is plump, winglets whittled for flight, tight, fraught, they are too tiny to contain the past. Her vast honed horizons have consumed it. They bask in the circuitry of now, their vigil fragile as they turn in tandem beneath the minimal eulogy of a fossil tree. She stares at me. I am known. For a moment, even think it possible to belong to this pre-world joy. Craving a greatness like a right, I swim close as the fleet accelerate, vanish, slow motion hearts into the undergold lit by silver fins and basket star. This next piece is written about a girl who reads the patterns of the bird as omens, and she chooses not to speak and to become mute. And I have some old English in the poem, and I'll translate that for you now so you won't be too surprised. And the translation is, strength, affliction, joy, to know, bird, bird, all. And the title of the poem is Tredolith. Country big girl reading the birds, their sideways latticing, banking left, lift, lift into anvil, manu, el, strangau, brock, drem, kanawan, brita, brita, yaw. To the dovecote straight through the orchard, she with her bow, past clocky colt, weir and sedge, the tundra swan smashing willow and cress, and the stream running bluely, brokenly. How she envied the white fiend, the wands churring in its slow eyes, roving beneath its webs. She listens to the small church in the breast of a finch. There is no other, for all the old gods have gone, leaving instead reddening wisteria and finch. Through the coon she wiles, unceasing, galloping, blown, not speaking, her silence curving in, racked out smooth, a vessel upon which her life elides, each day and its papers dissolving. At the dovecote, a wolf crunches the headbones of a bird. The girl kills, tends to the rest, feeding them white berries and seed. Another day passing, in which she is the greatest and least. She moves among the listeners, sets them free. They do not fly, but cluster on her shoulders, head, wrists, staying near, telling her every small thing, what cannot be named, the infinite miscalculations of once upon. When I got here, a friend from the Poetry Center pointed out a century plant right around the corner from me. And I'm sure you all know about century plants, but I had never heard of them, and I just thought they were phenomenal. So I thought I would go out on a limb and try to write a poem about it. And this poem is called Ancient Head. Inside itself for 40 years, the century plant's gargantuan flower stalk spews 15 feet aloft, then topples, hove torso, from its presidio of dying quills. Its ancient head, unsocratic, cast a single severe seed that torques into fissure, soon to pluck up between barrel bush and stones, tiny sabers faithfully pointed. Its first fatal blossom explains the lie of giving almost everything fast, belies the futility of beauty daily, cordoned and coiled into cut spectacle craving, glory growing in, abandoned, postponed, observing acids, radiances, decades of sun around a bare spool, articulating monsoon and moons into singular, phatic ruby. Century, witness us, the givers, splay-legged, nipple-pierced, pale grin, all out to everyone but those who love us. This is beginning of a small seduction series that lasts for 3 poems or so. The first poem is called The Seduction. Her bedroom looks out across the cave, a house, and I haunt the corner, angular and crude, brooding upon each incident, stare, and stir of her. I dissemble into the snow, my breast sliced for her. My instruments are confused, my feathers purpling in the glossing, and I will attack her, throat first, my beak pure down the lurch of her spine, her pain increasing, and with it, myself, on this dread day that I am wildest, spectacular, ruined fragment, petrific, abominable, and old, I belong to her. But first I will begin by spreading my cape so blue upon the ground and begging my beauty to sit upon it. Caution, my beloved. He kept her terrible on a small leash. She belonged to the second son, him, dark, over her. How she learned to perform, first unbelieving, fingers halting at her bone buttons, then with abandon, like a handful of thrown seed. Arms around her, often, unfastening, the chain hooked to her jeweled collar, attached to the eye vault opposite the vault. Gradually she began to move, only in relation to other things, to her cages and rack, the gallery and hook, the 36 steps to him. She grew older, limbs made formal by the variant postures craved. Sometimes, unseen series would crack, heal badly, though not so noticeable. She tried to escape once, crouched in the daylight darkness of a cane hamper, shuttled to the mill. She begged them to keep her, to give her work. The problem, never just the problem. And when he found her, she did not resist. For there was that in her that saw reason in all things, in the tongs that lift abreast, the delirious freedom after pain, and that this must be so. She torn, but mostly whole. Able to rest in the overlooked space, opening for those with a silent life. Here, serenity, a private wind. She tamed a bird, a small swift, essential to her. She watches it across fields, desperately flowering. At the appointed hour, she blindfolds herself, brushes her body with oils, his scent, him. She is burning. Never before had she felt so bright. Won't be so bad after that, I promise. This next poem I wrote when I was reading Virgil, and he was sort of describing this ancient creature that was lost in the modern world, and that described this next poem entitled Beloved. And I'm experimenting with some rhymes in this poem. Beloved, one. My unusual steps, rare spots and sound, I forage and fen, east headland, downs, sleek, unformed, sequeling, decelidating, born. I've taught bees to chronicle circumambial runes of woodruff, whatnot, wintergreen, wound, now gone, my own. Moons have thinned, archipelagos grown. I let you see me, hunter, though you begin my death. Come, lay down your bow. Night and again, I've thought of you, considered I ought to mend you. So sleep, clear, cool in my lair, outside, bay, wood thrush, wild pear. Yes, I'll drink what you're offering, thinking while, too. Wake, slight, shattered, shocked, and trapped, trust, dropped into all that is you. But that is not all, for don't you know I can ride if I choose, explode, shackle, murder a final ruse. But I'll wait, thinning, old, patient this love must be, and it is then I will beg you to set me free in a side green that death do, just one of me left to farther in the farthest dark, moving slowly. Flower to flower. This next poem is written about the death of Actaeon, who, as you may know, is from Ovid, and the goddess Diana, while she was bathing in a pool with her nymphs around her, saw Actaeon spying on her, so she turned him into a stag. And his own, unfortunately, his own hound. You hide, boy, mind shrewd on these breasts, kissed by the bare children who bathe me, as I rise from the soft pool, curtained by wild mint, by burning. Pray now, for your eyes will soon be wounds. Already your tame mouth goes wild, your shadow crouches on 4 feet. I inhale the scent of your blood as your own hounds gorge you. An apology, your antlers hang in the ash tree, their torn velvet bleaching in the sun. This next poem stems from sort of rebelling against having to go to confession. I was brought up Catholic, and I had to do that a lot. And you know, once you close that little booth robe, I mean, it's just you and this screen and this shadowy guy behind it. I've created my own sort of version, and there's somebody in here that I refer to as Grand Fa, and I just hope that everyone has a Grand Fa in their life, whatever that shape or form they take. What I most love. Stripped of my escorts, my false tail coil behind. Grandpa, I blush. You have caught me, one, forging my prayers. Two, tattooing a star print on my ass. Three, removing the starfish. I admit to all of the above, and to rudely rooting and rakishly roving through hip and shroud, despite chrism, theatic, and none, to parading my pookie, becoming background music a fat singer sings. I have flowered, furnaced, mirthed myself until over, broken I am, remain so, my sunninesses turn scrim. Give absolution and justice like tap, and I will come back to you, lucid limner, buoyant foyer, au fa. And though cleansed, I will continue to consume all that I shouldn't. These salamis, the late American promises, I spread before me like a fan, choosing first people of plenty, hero next, then justice for. Gnawing each fastidiously, knowing only cycle of flaw. If I could just know you, let me finger your strange torn edges, your crucifix, soothe your crooked, unmanageable limbs. Glittering cripple, dear fa, I am in the line moving tinily and forward toward an overstark hotel. Inside is just table adorned with skull and monk. Forgivances, sandwiches. How the lights judge, like we all do, not missing things small, a pointy shoe, the cadence of sneeze, if one will eat roast. What penance do? Pay what you wish. Should I give what I most love, the adequacies I covet under my fern full of far, my tiny flock of game? Or what I know best, the comfort of this distance between us, its impotence, its permanence. This next poem is written for a friend of mine who I recently visited the Desert Museum with. And we just had a great time, and we saw these mountain lions, and I dedicate this poem to him. The Lovers. Facing each other, the mountain lions sleep. The far ones, giant's paws touch, flop forward at the wrists to curl against the buttery tundra of his chest fur, its taut power unwound into molten, golden kitten, whose mighty ear tips sadden against the trial of his head. The lions rest, not like new lovers, who turn away in sleep as if already mourning what they've given too soon, but like ancient hearts who still, even in sleep, exchange. The lions will die here, an exhibit of their former selves, so exhale the heavy breath of the mountain from which they've come, a mountain bloated open, its wounds stolen and divided among the thieves who are their children, and their children sell their wounds, or wear them proudly, each glorious murder glittering upon breast, hands, throat. The wounds of a father become their own. And this poem is entitled Groove, and it's a hunting poem. It's about sort of learning to aim and shoot. Groove. Take my shoes. I give them to you to walk in, just up the hill. They are smaller than yours, the laces studded with small violet cakes. In turn, I'll take your gun, Smith Wesson, 12 gauge, bolt action. Looking down its barrel, a life with a hard oiled groove, I steady on you, strict against fields stunted with pheasant, the blue stem half forgiving the weasel looking inside of a newborn's egg, jaw jammed against the sight, butt flushed to shoulder, just as you teach. There is your heart, perpetually wavering, first above, then below, the bull's eye. The next poem I'm going to read begins a series about a woman named Y. And she began her life as bird songs, and she leads a life as part woman and part flying creature. And I found this really fabulous book called Born to Sing, A World Interpretation of Birdsong. And in the book, it talks about how all life is rhythm, and the rhythms of music constitute a universal language, which can be translated into birdsong if only we have the tools to decipher what they're saying. And the book takes an anti-behavioral standpoint towards birds, and it's a completely scientific book. It's not sort of one of these new age psychology books, which makes it even more fascinating that there are people out there who are really beginning to look at birds in this non-behavioral way. And in the poem itself, I have notations of bird songs. But because I would be terrible at one imitating them, I'm trying to translate, I have taped the first stanza of bird songs for you to listen to. And the poem is written in a biography form, just to let you know. And I would just like to read you one quote from the book, and that is, "Birds learn to talk only when the human teacher becomes a love object." And the title of the poem is Bird by Bird into This and This. She once was, in front of the startled nuns. 2010. Y is given her first platypus, whose tiny fins and bill provide her with an important but subtle connection to her ancestral past. 2013. Y, suffering from chronic insomnia, is taken by her mother to a psychiatrist named Walda, who tries to teach her meditation techniques with whale tapes. 2015. Dropping Walda, Y begins to fly at night, folding her wings carefully into her lunchbox before dawn. 2016. Y receives her 96th platypus. 2017. Y gets her first job in a grocery store wrapping head lettuce in cellophane. As her boss reprimands her for her addictive lateness, they hear the cellophane uncrinkling from 250 heads. Y is fired. 2022. Y enters college, where she shows virtuosity in languages and hypnotizes professors with her subtle vowel trills. 2023. 2023. Wise flying during adolescence increases its velocity. Sometimes she becomes a long-haired star before touching down behind her parents' colonial. 2024. Wye moves into a group house. Intolerant of her 300 platypuses, her roommates become mean. In retaliation, Wye blows up Evelyn's Stairmaster. 2026. Wye begins her first job as an administrative assistant. She becomes skilled in stuffing her science fiction novel into her top desk drawer. 2028. Noticing that her boss, Bonnie, has inadvertently spilled blusher on the tips of her shoes, Wye falls in love for the first time. Wye sets out to shock the office and seduces Bonnie. They jet to Paris for a weekend getaway. And in this illusory moment, strained by excessive amounts of pastry, caffeine, and sex, Wye realizes that Bonnie is perfect for her. Wye breaks up with Bonnie. Wye is fired. 2030. Ancient tragic motive reflected in the modern, Wye enters a period of obsessive flying, lonely for the love she shuns. She hunts the night flywheels, screaming above the tri-levels and branches, dropping her nature on expensive cars. 2031. Heedless of her reputation, Wye has now taken to flying in the daytime, gaudy and black-necked, randomly and promiscuously sparring with mockers and jars, joining great swarms of waterfowl, shorebirds, and other transients. 2036. Wye is dimly aware that she is trapped in finite grammars, constrained by a century that cannot define her. But she struggles toward alternative syntactical realms, the post-verbal. For her wings once lifted into a larger scheme, where there were extra positions, the band forms, infinite sequences. But she is here, where sometimes the birds are coarse and poor. 2036. Increasingly, Wye has great difficulty returning home, and this is the beginning of sorrow. She will fly until the word has shed its meanings. And the next two poems sort of explain a little what Wye has been up to since we've met her. And the title of this poem is, God Was Too Busy. Why, taking advantage of the fact that God was too busy watching sparrows, flew dangerously higher and faster, effortlessly attaining an escape velocity, propelling her deep into the ionosphere. And through the exosphere, Why burst, a fine, fluttering thing. She was not sure she was free. And there she met a girl who was no longer a bird, her heart no longer occupied with the thought of wanting to fly. Seeking such peace, Wye found her magnificent wings before the light blue girl, folding her visions into her primary feathers that emitted faint prisms in space light. The beauty hid Wye's wings, and our Wye was happy. Then she began to die. She missed blending into the evening's lightning, fields of silver potatoes falling away like lesser gilts, everything she meant to be taken from herself and suspended between two scarred hands. Wye asked the beauty for her wings back, but but learned that never would she see them again. But a stronger, swifter pair would be hers, if only she grieved deeply enough. And the second Wad poem is called Slight Bondage. Trapped in space, Wise thoughts narrowed into a series of perceptions that only bound her more intimately to the light blue girl. Young limbs chained, she did as commanded, hurling dark pageants into the comet drop. She has almost forgotten she could fly. The idea of wings faded as the rosettes in a grandmother's carpet, threadbare petals only visible to those who remember their shapes. And though far above the earth, why could distinguish the faint sound of a 40-year-old man's body crashing on top of his mother's dead one? The man would continue to despise his mother and need his mother, like a bashed bit of moon orbiting the universe that smashed it. The 70 song sequences in Y divide the form of a human heart, and this was the beginning of an immense crack beneath her feet, underneath the grief that would not come. And this final poem continues my bird obsession. It seems to have come over me when I was here. And I read this while watching all the birds upon the back patio of the Poetry Center's cottage. It's just amazing the amount of birds that land there. And that sort of led to this poem. And it's called Light Breathing. It started with just a few crumbs scattered on the patio, picked at by just a few thrashers, oval sonnets floriating in swags of sunlight damasking the southwest corner of the yard. Came the cactus wren, the peaked tuft, thistle threads essing an eye top, scuttling forward a burnished bolt with tail trucked up. And here tips a mourning dove, her roan stipples, tiny scapulas pushing up through the torn tin wing hues. She ticks breast first, sorrow, sorrow. And just then, the wood thrush barge in, belly squared, pied in miniature black bits, pinning a mingle of mottled browns. Why, multitudes have lived. Surely, a small circle of food is gone. Yet, they are everywhere, much more than there ought to be. Here's a veery, tawny jostle, boisterously bulging his faint honey bill. A pipit dusts, head, then tail down in it, all a fluff. Chestnut families, whirring. They're feeding each other now, landing upon clotheslines, prickly pear, lawn chairs. And suddenly as they come, up they all rise, plunging and pitching in the goldenness. Upblown and high, taking the yard and eye, far above, fluted fence, the adobes foreshortening as we lift delicately into the sparkle. And below is the cross that because I could not carry, I hung from. And now it is a slim fir laden with cones, infinitely dividing.